Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here, and I'm looking very much forward to give you a quick overview of, so you actually don't have to read the book, just to give you a sense of, that's a really, really bad thing to say if you're an author. But anyway, no, but the real point, of course, is I'd much rather have this message out and have a conversation about how do we get people to start thinking about how do we deal with global warming smartly. So I'll simply, it's one of the big issues of the world. We just have 20 minutes, so I'm going to rush right into it and give you a sense of how do we think right about global warming. Now, no presentation on global warming is complete without a picture of Al Gore. So here it is. Gore and I gave a presentation to Congress last year, and this is, I'm sure this is the second before he realizes who I am. Because he's still smiling. But the real point, of course, is that Gore and many others obviously are very much engaged in talking about how should we fix global warming? How should we approach global warming? I'd like to give you a sense of at least how I think we should think and get people to think about global warming. Because honestly, I mean, if you look at the UN Climate Panel, it puts out every 5-6 years, 3 reports, 800 pages each. And those pages are really just summaries of the tens of thousands of peer-reviewed published literatures that are out there. I mean, clearly nobody can have a good sense of how we should think about global warming with such an overwhelming amount of evidence. I'd like to try to reduce that and just give you a few pointers, at least, to what I think is the relevant ways to structure this debate to have a more sensible point. So I'm simply going to make 4 very basic points on how we should think about global warming. The first one is global warming is real and it's man-made. I think it's very hard to escape that is the foundation of what most scientists, certainly not all, but the vast majority of scientists are telling us today. And I think it's wrong to say, there's nothing about this. It's all, you know, natural variation or whatever. It might be. We should certainly fund people who will try to find errors in that argument and see if maybe it isn't all man-made. Maybe it isn't from CO2. But I think right now, that is what we know, and that's what we should embrace. So yes, global warming is a problem. It's definitely something we need to fix in the long run, but we also need to start having a conversation about how do we then best do this. So yes, temperatures will rise. It will be a problem. There's both going to be benefits and disbenefits, but mostly there are going to be disbenefits. I'll get into some of those later on, but global warming is real. It is a problem. That's the first point. The second point, however, is the consequences that we very often hear about global warming are often vastly exaggerated and one-sided, and that leads to panic. That leads to bad judgment. As we saw with the clip early on ethanol, I think it's a very good example of how panic is an unlikely way to make good judgments. Basically, if we think we're almost doomed, we're willing to do really, really stupid things like put food in our cars and thereby both, you know, have a huge amount of subsidies. It's estimated that we spend about $15 billion around the world on ethanol subsidies. At the same time, it means that we actually increase food prices, causing about 30 million people to starve, and we actually end up emitting more CO2. That's a lose-lose-lose situation, and that's the kind of thing that happens when we panic. So I would like to take you through, and I think this is an important part of the discussion, of saying we're often being presented with vastly exaggerated and one-sided arguments that do not lead us to make good judgments. Here, I'm again going to take Al Gore, not to pick on Al Gore, because there's so many out there who are saying the very same thing, but he just says it so very, very clearly. Al Gore talks about global warming as being planetary emergency. He says, and this is from his website, we have just 10 years to avert a major catastrophe that could send our entire planet into a tailspin of epic destruction involving extreme weather, floods, droughts, epidemics, killer heat waves, beyond anything we've ever experienced. In my book, I go through a lot of these different issues. I'd like to just take you to through 2 of these. Let's just look at heat deaths and malaria, the idea that we're going to have ever more killer heat waves and the fact that we're going to have ever more epidemics from global warming. All of what Al Gore says, and this is, I mean, again, this is not about bashing Al Gore because so many people say this, all of these statements are technically true but dramatically misleading. Now, let me show you how. If we look at, for instance, heat mortality, are we going to see more heat mortality with global warming? Absolutely. As temperatures rise, we're going to see more heat waves. We're going to see more people dying from heat. It's really not that complicated. We have some of the best studies that have been done in Europe, and a cross-country study with lots and lots of different academics in Europe for most of the European nations. If you look, for instance, in Britain, it's estimated that due to global warming, we will see about 2,000 more people die from heat in Britain every year by mid-century. Now, that's certainly important to point out. Certainly, it's also being pointed out very, very often. But we should recognize that, yes, global warming will have this problem. There's going to be 2,000 people dying each year. But the curious point, of course, is to realize that's not the only impact of global warming. If temperatures rise, yes, we're going to see more heat waves. But, of course, as temperatures rise, we're also going to see fewer cold waves and, therefore, fewer cold deaths. It seems reasonable, at least, to try to estimate that. Now, of course, if this was a trivial number of people, maybe it wouldn't matter. But it's not. The very same studies that tell us that there's going to be 2,000 more people dying from extra heat in Britain by 2050 also show us that because of increasing temperatures from global warming, we're going to see about 20,000 fewer cold deaths in Britain by mid-century. My point is simply to say it's technically true to go out and say, oh, my God, we're going to see 2,000 more people die from heat because of global warming. But it's not very well informative if we neglect the fact that we're actually going to see 20,000 fewer die from coal. Now, again, you might say, Bjorn is from Denmark. You know, maybe we think global warming is a cool thing. And the same thing might be true for the UK, but surely this is not true for most of the world. Well, actually, the only peer-published estimate that looks at the global impact on this actually estimate that this is true for virtually all areas and definitely true for the planet as a whole. We actually expect by mid-century to have about 400,000 extra heat deaths, but about 1.8 million fewer cold deaths. So, yes, on this particular issue, global warming is actually a good thing. Now, notice, I'm not then saying, hey, maybe we should have more global warming, because the point is that there are many other problems with global warming, and I've listed some of these up here, and we'll probably also talk about them when we have the questions. But the whole point is to say, if we're only being told one side, and a very one-sided argument, we're unlikely to make good judgment. So we need to have the information on both sides and recognize that global warming, just like any other problem, is a problem both with disbenefits, but also benefits. And overall, there are more disbenefits than benefits. That's why it's a problem. That's why we need to fix it. But we should be honest and tell the full story. There's another problem with this argument as well, and that is if we only talk about global warming causing more heat deaths, we very easily end up saying, and that's certainly what Al Gore and many others will tell us, that's why we need to cut carbon emissions to help people from not dying from heat. But really, is that the best way to help these people? The biggest heat wave in the U.S. was actually not all that dramatic. It was in Chicago in 1996. But the biggest heat wave that we've seen globally was in Europe in 2003, in August 2003, where about 35,000 people died across the continent, 7,500 just in Paris, France, mostly old ladies who died in their apartments. And obviously, a lot of people will say, this is what the future is going to look like because of global warming. That's why we need to cut carbon emissions, because that's how we're going to avoid future 7,500 old ladies dying in Paris, France. My question is simply to say, is cutting carbon emissions the right way to do that? Obviously, if we start cutting carbon emissions, yes, the temperature will rise, but it will rise slightly less. So what we're essentially telling these future old ladies in Paris, France is, you're going to die more and more, but slightly less more and more. It's not obvious that that's really the best way we could do it. It seems to me that there are much better policies against heat. I mean, listen, there are almost no deaths, heat deaths in the U.S. Why? Because you have air conditioning. Maybe if we actually want to help those old ladies in Paris, France, we should give them air conditioning. That way, none of them would die. Now, of course, a lot of people feel somewhat uncomfortable about giving air conditioning because that also means that we're going to put out more CO2. But there are also other ways. One of the crucial points is to recognize that most cities around the world are much warmer than the surrounding countrysides. Tokyo, for instance, is about 20 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than its surrounding countrysides. Why? Because there are lots of tarmac, lots of black surfaces, very little greenery, very little water available in most of these cities. Since 80% of humanity is going to live in cities by the end of the century, it's certainly a crucial issue of saying cities are generally going to be much, much warmer. We could do something about that. We could do something about it very, very simply. If you look at London, add more greenery and water features, And we know that that, at very low cost, would actually reduce daytime maximum temperatures in London by about 14 degrees Fahrenheit. Much, much more than what global warming will ever do, and much, much, much more than what we could ever do through global warming policies. So if we actually want to help Londoners, we know of much cheaper, much nicer technologies that would do much more good. Why are we not talking about that first? And the other obvious incidents, a lot of people actually laugh a little bit about that, but I think it crucially shows how far we've gotten away from actually talking about what would work. I mean, it's very, very simple. If it's dark tarmac that causes most of the heat buildup in most cities where most people will live by the end of the century, why don't we paint the tarmac? Why don't we paint rooftops? We actually know. Make them light. It would actually, for London, estimate to reduce daytime temperatures by about 18 degrees Fahrenheit. Much more, again, than what we could ever do with global warming policies. My point is simply twofold to say, when we're being told there are going to be more killer heat waves, yes, there will be 2,000 more heat deaths, but we've failed to be told that there will be 20,000 fewer cold deaths. And also, we're being told, so the way to help these people from not dying from heat waves is by cutting carbon emissions. Well, no, actually, it's about giving people air conditioning or making greener cities, making more wet cities, making lighter cities. The way that we can deal with these issues much, much cheaper. And this goes through all of the different issues that we talk about with global warming. Unfortunately, I don't have time to go through each and every one of them. But the fundamental point remains that every time we say, here's a problem from global warming, many times it's true that there is a problem from global warming, but there's just an incredibly much cheaper way to deal with that problem. So if that's actually what we worry about, why is it we don't fix it through the cheapest or the most effective way to deal with these problems? Let me just show you the other point, the malaria point that Gore mentioned before. We're going to see more malaria because of global warming. That's probably true. Malaria is weakly correlated to heat, so we estimate because of increasing temperatures by the end of the century, we're likely to see about 3% more malaria. Then people will say, so we should do something about carbon emissions. We should cut carbon emissions. But clearly, there's something fundamentally wrong about saying, let's worry about 3% malaria in 100 years, when there's 100% malaria right now that we can do something about very, very quickly and very simply. I mean, yes, malaria is weakly correlated to temperature, but it's strongly correlated to wealth. Basically, if you're rich, you don't get malaria, and even if you get malaria, you don't die from malaria. If you're poor, you get malaria and you die from malaria. So my question again is, what should we be focusing on first? Should we really be focusing on doing something about the temperature, or should we be focusing on doing something about treatment? Well, let me give you a sense of the proportion. If we look at what we can do on two very, very simple policies, one is the Kyoto Protocol, the other one is focusing on malaria-specific policies, if everybody, including the U.S., had signed up to the Kyoto Protocol and actually kept all their promises, which, by the way, almost all of the countries haven't done, but if everybody had done so, and all of them had done so all the way through the 21st century, a very, very heroic assumption, we would have avoided every year about 1,400 deaths from malaria through the Kyoto Protocol. Now, I think that's great. I certainly want to be part of a civilization that saves 1,400 people dying each year. But isn't it curious that we don't seem to talk very much about the fact that had we actually invested in malaria-specific policies, we could have saved 850,000 people from dying every year? And, oh, by the way, the Kyoto Protocol is about 60 times more expensive than these malaria policies. Or to put it differently, for every time Al Gore, through climate change policies, can save one person from dying from malaria, the same amount of money spent on actually helping people with malaria could save 36,000 people from dying from malaria. Isn't it simply better to save 36,000 people before you save one? And that, I think, is the crucial point. To say, yes, there are problems with global warming. It is a real issue, but very often, trying to do something about it, first of all, we very often do it really badly, but also to the extent that we do so to actually help people who are going to have problems with heat deaths or who are going to have problems with malaria is probably the poorest, the most inefficient way to help these people. So if we actually care about those people, we could do it so much smarter. And that really is my third point. So yes, global warming is real. It's often vastly exaggerated and one-sided, which leads to bad policy judgment. And that's why we need to have smarter options. Basically, the problem is right now, the current policies do nothing at very, very high cost. I mean, take a look at Kyoto. It would probably cost, this is the average of all the macroeconomic models, about $180 billion a year. Yet the effect would have been virtually zero. It would have reduced temperatures by the end of the century by about 0.007 degrees Fahrenheit. And because most countries are actually not obliging, it'll probably reduce it at 0.0004 degrees Fahrenheit. I mean, we won't even be able to measure the difference in 100 years. And you've got to ask yourself, is that really the best way we can spend money? Europe has just pledged that they're going to save the world since nobody else is. And Europe liked those kinds of statements. And I did a calculation for Britain. Britain is actually engaged in saying they're going to cut the emissions by 20% by 2020, 20% down to 1990 levels. I'm assuming the main reason for this is 20% cut by 2020 sounds really good. And the idea is that they have also decided how they're going to do it, namely through renewables. The problem is renewables are incredibly expensive. So I did this cost analysis for the UK, where they've actually come out very, very clearly and said, what is the cost? Well, it turns out that the cost is about £100 billion to do this, just for Britain. And they've also come out and said, how much are they actually going to cut in CO2 emissions? And then we tried to have the Times of London call around to a lot of different research and said, well, how much is that actually going to reduce temperature? Nobody wanted to calculate that. And they said, well, isn't that a relevant question? And they said, no. You would imagine if you're going to spend £100 billion, maybe it's a relevant question, how much are you actually going to get out of it? I think I know why they didn't want to answer that question, because then I ran a very simple model. It's just one model, but it probably gives you a pretty good sense of what the effect is. It will probably reduce temperatures in the world by about 1,600th of a degree Fahrenheit by the end of the century. That's not a whole lot, is it, for £100 billion? Then, of course, people say, but that only shows that everybody's got to do this. Well, maybe. Anyway, Britain is about 2% of the global emissions, so you could imagine that there's essentially 50 UKs around the world. If all 50 of them did it, and we assume the same cost structure, well, that means we should probably do 50 times as much. I should just say for every pound the UK spend, they probably do about 4 pence, or what would be a cent for you, 4 pence of global good. So if everybody did this, the cost would be about 5,000 billion pounds, and yet by the end of the century, we would not be able to see the difference. We'd have 1/30th of a degree Fahrenheit lower temperatures. Again, my question is simply, why is it that we're so engaged in doing something that would be hugely costly and actually do virtually no good? And this is no coincidence. Actually, all major peer-reviewed published cost-benefit analyses show that doing something about global warming is just not worth the cost. If you look at all peer-reviewed published studies, this is what you see over here. You can basically see that the damages from global warming are, obviously there's wide error bias, but this is what we expect, about 1% of GDP cost and damages. But the cost of doing something about it is about 2% 2% of GDP, which is why it's a bad idea to give 2% to avoid 1% of loss. That's the basic cost-benefit analysis here. You probably heard about the Stern Review, which was a review commissioned by the British government to show that global warming policies actually make sense. Not surprisingly, the Stern Review came out and said the British government was spot on. But the Stern Review dramatically changed what the costs and damage costs were. They actually said the damage was hugely greater than what period published studies were. Notice that the Stern Review only relied on the studies that you see here. But it simply managed to make this much, much greater, and the cost of doing so much, much less. That's why it came out with a very different one. The Stern Review is not, surprisingly, not peer-reviewed, and it's simply the only one that makes that argument. And the problem here is simply that our economic analysis, just like the science analysis telling us, yes, climate change is real, the economic analysis is overwhelmingly telling us that cutting carbon emissions right now is a very poor way of helping the world far into the future. And that's why I say there is a lack, fundamental lack, of understanding of saying, what are the smart solutions? And before I get to tell you what are the smart solutions, let me just sort of give you the metaphor, which I think so vividly encapsulates this whole debate. Take polar bears. Polar bears, in many ways, have become the icon of global warming. People say, oh my God, you know, we've got to cut carbon emissions for polar bears. Well, first of all, most people believe that polar bears are threatened right now. Yes, polar bears probably will be threatened by the fact that that disappearing and eventually summer Arctic ice will probably mean fewer polar bears. But let's just remember that polar bears have actually increased dramatically over the last 50 years. They've probably increased from about 5,000 to 22,000. So right now there's no problem, but there will probably be a problem with polar bears towards the middle of the century. But my question then is, what can we do about it? Most people will then say, well, cut carbon emissions. Nobody tells you how many polar bears you're actually going to save from that. I think I know why. Again, if you run the models, if you do, for instance, the Kyoto Protocol, if you again assume everybody that the Kyoto Protocol, including the U.S., everybody stuck to it throughout the rest of the century, the effect of this would be probably to save about one polar bear each year. Now, I'm all for saving a polar bear a year, even at a cost of a couple hundred billion dollars, but it strikes me as curious that we have no discussion about the fact that, yes, we could save one polar bear by this very, very costly policy input. But at the same time, we shoot polar bears every year. Actually, and most people don't know this, actually, we shoot globally somewhere between 300 and 500 polar bears each year. I don't know about you, but maybe we should stop shooting 300 polar bears first. I mean, apart from the fact that it would be incredibly much cheaper, it would also be better for 299 polar bears. Right? And notice, this is not saying that eventually we'll also have to start cut carbon emissions, because eventually this is not going to be enough. But the point here is to realize that when we're talking about even the metaphor of polar bears, we're not talking about what would actually be the most efficient. Well, if we want to save polar bears, let's stop shooting them. It'd be much cheaper and much more effective, at least in short and medium-term range. And that's why I think we need to have a better conversation on global warming. So my solution to thinking about global warming and thinking about what would be smart is much more about saying, let's invest in research and development to find better technologies for the future. I actually propose, we're going to meet, the world is going to meet in Copenhagen in late 2009, so about 13 months from now, to negotiate the next Kyoto Protocol. Instead of this Kyoto Protocol being another one of, let's cut a lot and then come up to whatever date we decide and realize, we didn't actually do it. Maybe we should start having a different kind of conversation. Maybe we should promise ourselves to spend 0.05% of GDP in research and development and demonstration of non-carbon-emitting energy technologies. The point of doing so is that it would be about $25 billion a year globally. This would be 10 times cheaper than the Kyoto Protocol, yet it would be 10 times more than what we spend now. And the metaphor really is very, very simple. It is about saying, let's not put up a lot of the inefficient technology that we have right now. Look, Germany is the world's biggest spender on solar panels. It spends about $160 billion on solar panels, the net effect of which will be to postpone global warming by about 1 hour at the end of the century. So, there's no point in spending all this money. Essentially, it just goes up on those rooftops to make people feel good about themselves. But the curious point is to say, why is it, if we really want to fix climate change, why is it we spend money on inefficient technology instead of spending money on making technology much more efficient? Imagine if we actually had spent that money on research and development to make solar panels cheaper. They won't be cheaper tomorrow. They won't be cheaper in 10 years. But imagine if our research and development could make solar panels cheaper than fossil fuels by, say, 2040. We would have fixed global warming. People would switch to solar panels, not because they're good, not because they're green, but because we had made it cheaper. And, of course, that would especially hold for China and India and all the other developing countries that are up and coming. They're not going to be incredibly green, but if we have technologies for them, they'll be cheaper than fossil fuels. Of course they'll pick those. And so the idea here is to say, instead of focusing on buying inefficient technologies, let's focus on making those technologies efficient. I don't think we have any good idea of whether it should be solar panels. There's lots of different opportunities. It could be solar, it could be wind turbines, it could be fission, fusion, conservation, carbon storage, second generation, biofuels. There are lots of different opportunities. But the point is, if we start investing in this, it'll be much cheaper, it'll have much greater chance of actually having success at the Copenhagen negotiations, and it'll have a much greater chance of actually doing good in solving global warming. Actually, preliminary studies indicate that this would fix global warming in the medium term. This would be the way forward. And oh, by the way, for every dollar we invest in research and development, our studies indicate that that would end up doing about $11 worth of good. Contrary to the sort of 4 cents worth of good that the Brits are spending right now on their renewables, this would do an amazing amount more good for the world. And so my point is simply to say, yes, global warming is real. It's often vastly exaggerated, which leads to bad judgment. And that's why we need smarter solutions, focus on research and development. I did promise you 4 points, and I'm just going to make the last point because I think this is a crucial one, also in bringing in everybody else. Bottom line is, there's many other problems in this world, and there are many other places where we can actually do a lot more good. Al Gore talks about global warming as our generational mission. He says, how do you want to be remembered by your kids and grandkids? I think that's exactly the right way to think about this problem. How do you want to be remembered by your kids and grandkids? I'm often very, very surprised about the fact that Al Gore and many, many other well-meaning people around society seem to want to be remembered by their kids and grandkids for having spent $180 billion every year doing virtually no good even 100 years from now. I'm not sure my kids and grandkids are going to say, great going there, Granddad. The point, of course, and just to give you a sense of proportion, the UN estimate that for much less than half that amount, we could basically fix all major problems in the world. We could give clean drinking water, sanitation, basic health care, and education to every single human being on the planet. How would you like to be remembered? For spending twice as much money doing no good, or half that amount and fixing all major problems in the world today? I mean, when you put it that way, it's really not that hard of a question, is it? But never mind, we seem not to get this point. Of course, we should probably also spend $25 billion on fixing climate change in the medium term. But the point is, that would still only be about half of what is proposed just on doing the Kyoto Protocol. And that's why I think we need to start having a conversation about how do we actually do good. And you mentioned the Copenhagen Consensus, and let me just stop on that account. I helped bring together some of the world's top economists. We had 50 of the world's top economists across a vast range of different areas come up with saying lots of problems, lots of solutions in this world, but simply rank those solutions according to where do you do the most bang for the buck? Where do you actually solve the most problems for every dollar you spend? This was what they came up with. The top priorities in the world would be micronutrients, free trade immunizations, and agricultural research and development. Just to give you a sense of proportion, micronutrients. Most people know about malnutrition. We think about people not having enough food, which is about half of the death toll of malnutrition. But the other half, and the vast incident, is actually due to the lack of micronutrients. The fact that most people in this world don't have enough access to simple micronutrients like vitamin A, zinc, iron, and iodine. That causes them to be less mentally and physically developed than they would otherwise be. Take, for instance, iron. About 2 billion people in this world, about one-third of the world's population, lack iron, more or less. And that means, on average, that they're 17% less strong than they could otherwise be. They lack 15 IQ points. If we provided them essentially with a vitamin pill, we could pretty much overcome that. And often it's much easier than that. Give them an iron pot, and it'll slowly diffuse the iron into their food and basically make them smarter and stronger. This is about one half of the world's population. And how much would that cost? It costs about $300 million. Not billion, million dollars. To help half the world's population be stronger, be better off, and deal with all their other problems much, much more effectively. That's just one of the many things. I'm simply pointing out, if we actually want to do good, I think we also have to recognize that much of what happens in the global warming discussion is about wanting to do good. I simply want to focus people on saying, well, if you want to do good, why don't we do a lot of good rather than a little good? On the 14th space, the expert told us that's energy research and development. It's not the best thing to do, but certainly a respectable thing. For every dollar we spend up on micronutrients, we probably do some $20, $30 worth of good in the world. If we spend it on energy research and development, as I just mentioned, we'll do about $11 worth of good, but it's still good. But what the experts, what these Nobel laureates, including five Nobel laureates, told us was, please, 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 whatever else you do, don't just cut carbon emissions. It was on the very last spot of the list, and what they essentially estimated was, even if you do really, really well, for every dollar you spend, you only do 90 cents worth of good. Not a very good idea. So at the end of the day, this really is just about saying, yes, global warming is real. It's often vastly exaggerated, which is why we need smarter solutions. Let's pick those smarter solutions on number 14 rather than number 30. Let's pick them smart rather than stupidly. And then also let's remember that there are many other problems in this world that we can fix so much cheaper and do so much more good. So if this is really a question about saying, let's do good in the world, well, then let's do real good and not just make ourselves feel good about what we do. Thank you.